Okay, so I'd like to, of course, thank the organizers for the invitation to speak here, but also for organizing what so far has been a very good meeting, I think, in general. I'd like to discuss today a number of properties that appear to be related to integrability, that appear to pull out what we would call the discrete Penleve equations from a more general class of equations, much in the same way as the Penleve property does for differential equations. The Penleve property is a property that lives in the complex plane. And one of the earlier pieces of work that we did with Mark Ablowitz and Ben Hobst was to consider difference equations in the complex plane and ask what kind of complex analytic properties correlate to integrability. And the conclusion that we came up with, or the suggestion that we came up with, was that you should look at the difference equations. They, in general, will admit finite order. Sorry, they'll in general admit meromorphic solutions. If you demand that those solutions be of finite order, this seems to bring you down to what we think of as the discrete Penleve equations. So what I'd like to do today is to briefly mention some more recent work in this direction with Risto Korhonen, in which we classify equations from a certain class with this property, and we see it does seem to agree with a list of what we'd call the discrete Penleve equations. I'd like to clarify the connection between that approach and singularity confinement. So here, singularity confinement will be used as a tool for measuring the relative frequency of certain points in the complex plane. And then by something called Voiter's dictionary, which is a mysterious way of relating ideas in number theory and Nevin-Linna theory, we're led to another idea of integrability, and that's what I call Diophantine integrability. And that is, rather than demanding that you have a meromorphic function that grows particularly slowly in the complex plane, you have some other measure of the complexity of your solution. Now it's a number theoretic measure, and that measure grows slowly. That measures the height of an algebraic number. If you're talking about rational numbers, the height of a rational number is just the maximum of the denominator and the numerator. Again, I'd like to show you some preliminary work that uses this criterion to pull out what we would consider the discrete Penleve equations, again, from a list of equations, including some both necessary and sufficient conditions for an equation to be Diophantine integrable. And then I'd like to discuss connections with algebraic entropy. Okay, so firstly, Nevin-Linna theory. I'm not going to give you a course in Nevin-Linna theory, but there are a couple of terms that I will have to use. So don't be afraid of all of the formulas here. Let me summarize the basic idea. The idea is that you start off with a meromorphic function. And what we do is we consider how that function behaves on a certain disk and look at certain properties as the radius of that disk goes off to infinity. And that the object that we construct in that case is the Nevin-Linna characteristic. So again, you imagine fixing a meromorphic function f, and now this object is a function of r, and you ask yourself, how does that function behave as r zooms off to infinity? In the case of an entire function, then the Nevin-Linna characteristic is basically the log of the maximum of the function on the disk. For meromorphic functions, the story, of course, is a bit more complicated. You can't talk about the maximum on the disk because you have lots of points where the function will be infinite in general. So now it becomes a sum of two terms. The first term is essentially an average of how big f gets, or the log of f gets, on the radius of the circle itself. Okay, and the other contribution, capital N, is a measure of how many poles the function attains on the inside of the disk. So strictly, there's little n, so this is the thing that's more natural to think about, which is simply the number of poles inside the disk of radius r, counting multiplicity. So if you have a double pole, it contributes 2 to this sum. And all that f being a finite order function means is that t grows like a polynomial rather than as an exponential or higher. So, for example, the exponential function and linear combinations of exponentials and the elliptic functions are all finite order functions, but double exponentials are infinite order. And again, various authors, Kimura, Shimomura, Yanagihara, show that if I have a first order equation of this form, at least if I temporarily remove the z dependence here, then you can always find meromorphic solutions, non-constant meromorphic solutions. However, if you demand that not only do you have a meromorphic solution, but that you have a finite order meromorphic solution, then this rational function of y on the right-hand side collapses down to a Möbius-type transformation. And then this equation becomes then what we call the discrete Riccati equation. Okay, it's an equation that can be linearized. You can write the solution down in terms of the solution of a linear difference equation. So there we have an example where this order condition was used to pull out an integrable equation, much as the Panleve property works in the differential case. So this and some other evidence led us to suggest that the analog or an analog for the Panleve equation, the Panleve property for differential equations in the difference setting, would be the existence of sufficiently many finite order meromorphic solutions. I'm not going to demand that all solutions be finite order, because you always have arbitrary periodic functions that arise in the solutions of these equations, so you can always crank the order up and destroy regularity. So with this criterion in mind, Yanagihara had done some higher order earlier work. Various people came up with a number of necessary conditions for the existence of finite order solutions of equations that gave pretty good dependence on the dependent variable. Okay, so the y part was cut down fairly precisely, but essentially gave no information on the types of coefficients that you can have. As with the differential case, the coefficients of the Riccati equation can be general and you can still linearize it, but usually once you're talking about higher order equations, these functions get pinned down pretty precisely, as we know from the differential Panleve equations. So more recently, with work with Risto Korhonen at Joensuu, we considered this class of equations. So the up bar means w at z plus 1, the down bar means w at z minus 1, and w just means w at z. And we considered w up plus w down as a rational function of w with arbitrary meromorphic coefficients. And the assumption is, suppose that you have a finite order meromorphic solution, and we have to add in this term admissible, which sounds like a fudge, but it's not. Admissible means that the solution, in the sense of Nevin-Liner, grows faster than the coefficients. If the coefficients are polynomials or rational functions, that would simply mean that your solution is a non-rational function. Why do we need a criteria for that? Well, that's very easy. I could write down essentially any equation of this form at all, just leave one of the coefficient functions free, determine all of the other coefficients to be whatever I like, write down the solution, the thing that I want to be the solution of this equation, and now solve for the remaining coefficient. Now, by construction, I have an equation with this thing as a solution. However, in general, the coefficient there will be as complicated as the solution itself. So to rule that out, you need some kind of an admissibility criterion. So that's the meaning of that. And the upshot of this theorem says that if you've got a finite order, an admissible finite order meromorphic solution, then either your function actually solves a first order, a nice first order equation. It actually solves a Riccati equation, and that's why really if you demand that you have more solutions, you can rule that case out. Or your equation up to a linear transformation in W is one of these equations in this list here. Now, essentially, all of the equations in this list have been seen before. They are what we call the discrete Panleve equations that have arisen in various contexts, with a possible exception maybe of an equation like this, the problem being that usually, of course, people think of discrete equations naturally enough on the lattice, and on the lattice, minus 1 to the n squared is 1. But in the complex plane, minus 1 to the z squared is not. So we can't as easily at least transform this equation away. But apart from that, this is essentially the list that's been seen. The pi's and the kappas are arbitrary periodic functions with periods that are equal to the coefficient, the subscripts. If we set pi 1 to be 0, if we turn off the explicit z dependence here, all of these equations can be solved in terms of elliptic functions, and again, they are finite order meromorphic functions. In general, I think it's safe to say that people believe the discrete Panleve transcendence asymptotically look like some kind of elliptic functions. And if we take that asymptotics strongly enough, then that would again suggest that the solution should be finite order, but we do not have a proof at this stage. So what I'd like to concentrate on before leaving this Nevin-Linna approach is not the Nevin-Linna side of it at all, but actually the connection with singularity confinement. Sometimes when I've talked about this in the past, I've said, and now we use singularity confinement to get some information. And I think sometimes there's a belief that confinement is something that goes on indefinitely and you're never quite sure when you have an answer. So I thought it would be nice just to explain that. So the only Nevin-Linna theory that we're going to need at this point is, if you just believe me because I'm a nice guy, that if you can, well, let me remind you of the notation to start with. Little n of ry is again the number of poles of y in the disk of radius r, counting multiplicities. Therefore, nr of 1 over y is the number of zeros of y in the disk of radius r, counting multiplicities. And the upshot here is that if we can show this inequality, if I can show that the number of zeros inside a disk of radius r is much, much smaller than the number of poles of y in a slightly bigger disk. This is equivalent for finite order anyway, but not what we'll show initially will be with an r plus 1 in here. So if you look in a slightly bigger disk and you count the number of poles there, if you've got much fewer zeros in the smaller disk, then your function is necessarily infinite order. That's not a general statement for meromorphic functions. That's particular to solutions of this equation. But this is where all of the machinery of Nevin-Linna theory comes in, and that's not what I'm going to talk about today. What I'd like to talk about today is how we get this identity, maybe with one other statement from Nevin-Linna theory, and that is you can show very easily any finite order meromorphic solution of this thing should have a lot of poles. Okay, so a lot in particular meaning infinitely many. Okay, but a lot, again, measured compared to the size of the coefficients. So how do you go about trying to show an identity like this that holds in general, and what's the connection with singularity confinement? Well, start off with this idea. We're trying to track the number of zeros here. So imagine that y has a zero at a certain point. I'm going to ignore points where a and b vanish. Again, you have to do a little bit more work there. So as long as I'm away from such a point, if y has a zero of order k, then this sum has a pole of order 2k, and so at least one of those two terms must have a pole at least of order 2k. So the basic idea now is to, at any zero of the function, to consider a string of values such that at every second value I have a zero of the function of order k, and at all the other values I have, at all the other points in the sequence, I have a pole of order at least 2k. Okay, so now every zero in the complex plane is accommodated for in exactly one of these sequences. And now what we're going to do is we're going to try to get the balance between zeros and poles in each one of these sequences, get a uniform bound, and that's going to give us an identity of this form in general. And what you're left with are the Panleve equations. So how do we do that? Well, the first thing is we're going to consider in each one of these sequences, we're going to just count the number of zero poles and divide that by the number of zeros, counting multiplicities, and then what that would mean is that if all the zeros and poles were in a sequence of that type, alpha here would basically be 1 over r. Okay, but we're going to get a number of lower bounds here. Okay, so let's start. Suppose that we've got an even number of points. Okay, well, if we've got an even number of points, then we've got the same number of zeros as we do poles, not counting multiplicities. But the multiplicity of the pole is at least twice that of the zero. So we have a ratio here of 2. So if all the zeros and poles were in sequences with an even number, such as this, alpha here would be a half, and we'd have infinite order solutions by this lemma. What happens if there's an odd number of points? Well, you call it L. Well, in that case, there are at least L minus 1 over 2 poles, and there are at most L plus 1 over 2 zeros. So again, the ratio of zeros to poles is the ratio of those two numbers multiplied by 2, and then maybe a bit bigger, because again, the order of the poles was at least twice the order of the zeros. So we get this expression, And so if our odd number now is at least 5, that number is bigger than or equal to 4 over 3. So what that means is that if all of our zeros and poles are occurring in such sequences, we're left with 4 over 3 here, which would correspond to alpha being 3 over 4, so that would again lead us to infinite order. So what are we left with? Well, we know that we have infinitely many poles, again, so if this thing isn't satisfied immediately, we've got to have infinitely many zeros. So if all but a finite number of zeros were in the simpler case, again, we'd be left with with infinite order. So we must have infinitely many infinitely many zeros that live in sequences like this that have length either 1 or 3, because we've ruled out all the evens, we've ruled out all of the odds bigger than 5. Well, by the definition, it doesn't make sense to have a sequence of 1. Okay, we've already seen that you'll have at least 1 pole, so that leaves you with a sequence of 3. So what that means, again, just to summarize, is if I look at the zeros of this solution and I look at these chains, then either this ratio is going to be bigger than or equal to 4 over 3, or I'm going to have lots of points. Again, in the rational case, that simply means infinitely many points. It means more points than these functions can possibly have without being constant in the general case. But if I take these things to be rational, it's saying that there'd be infinitely many points such that y vanishes. Then you're in a sequence of 3 points. So either I've got 2 zeros and a pole or 2 poles and a zero. Well, the 2 poles and a 0, again, this ratio is huge, it's 4. So it must be the case that zeros only occur in a sequence that looks like 0, infinity, 0. And at the next iterates, because they're not part of the sequence, I could still have poles, but the order of those poles must be less than 2k, because that's the way that we defined this sequence. So that's forcing us, in the case, to have infinitely many points where we have exactly that situation. Okay, so at most a low-order pole, then a 0, twice the order pole, a 0, and at worst, a low order pole. And now you're led to singularity confinement. I should say that we need to push this argument a little bit more to get that number which is less than 2k. That is enough to give us one of the two conditions that we need. You have to work a little bit harder, but actually not very hard, but I just don't want to go through it now, to get that to be a number less than k. Okay, you can actually get it to be less than any number less than k. So now you run through the argument, you say, okay, suppose I've got a zero somewhere. On one side of it, I've got to have, at worst, a low-order pole. On the other side, well, already at that point, you're now in singularity confinement territory. You just list out do the expansion. Somehow this W turned into a Y, or the other way around. Sorry about that. All W's and Y's are equivalent. Delta here is plus or minus 1, just you're stepping in one direction or another. And I'm expanding in terms of y itself, because y near z equals 0 by assumption, or near z equals z naught, has a 0, so it's a nice thing to expand in terms of. And y at z minus delta is just some not particularly big term. So we can do the expansion of this form. Here we have by assumption a 0 at z naught, then we've got a pole of order twice whatever the 0 was. Here we have a 0 again because W is Y, and I really wish I hadn't done that. And then at the next term, you can see generically we'd have a double pole and then a simple pole here. But we said that we can't have infinitely many terms where you have a pole of such a high order. So this term must vanish and this term must vanish, which gives you these two discrete equations. As I said, in the rational function, this has to happen at a lot of points. So in particular, in the rational function case, this has to happen infinitely often. Well, the only way that I could have this happen with rational functions infinitely often is if these two things now become equations, and that gives you exactly the criterion that you get from singularity confinement. And one thing I'd like to point out here is that from this way of looking at things, singularity confinement is a way of determining ratios of relative values of functions. So we're not thinking of it in terms of information propagation, although that's another way of thinking of it, but we're looking at it as determining relative frequencies of values of a meromorphic function. If you look at the example of Hitiorinta and VLA that was mentioned in the previous talk, this is a classic case where of an equation that's known that has the singularity confinement property, but numerically exhibits chaos, so we wouldn't think of it as a discrete Fermat-Weyl equation. So what would you do in that case? Just the usual way of doing singularity confinement. You'd say to yourself, how do I go from a finite value to infinity? Well, I have to hit zero. So you call that thing epsilon so that you can track through the singularity and then set epsilon to be zero. So you can see you go finite value, zero, infinity, infinity, zero, back to finite values, and you believe that you stay back at finite values. How would we reinterpret that in our case? Well, we'd replace this discrete equation by this equation in the complex plane. You get pretty much the same kind of a calculation. Why are we led to something different? Well, again, all that singularity confinement gives us is the ratio of relative values, zeros to poles. And the same thing happens here. It's simply in this case that it gives you an inequality, and that inequality isn't enough to give you to be consistent with finite order growth. It still gives you infinite order growth. By the way, this is the hard way of doing this. We know that this has infinite order from the from much earlier work, but I just wanted to kind of try to connect it directly with singularity confinement. Okay, so the next thing I'd like to talk about is Voiter's dictionary, which is a strange observation that was made independently by Osgood and Voiter. And that is that if you look at the formal structure of Nevin-Linnar theory, the theory of meromorphic functions, and the formal structure of Diophantine approximations, so the an area of number theory and part of algebraic number theory and arithmetic geometry, two distinct, what look like very different areas studying very different things, there's a formal similarity between the definitions, the theorems, many different results. And people have used this in the two, it's just a heuristic, but it's a very powerful heuristic, and people have used it to base conjectures in one area on theorems in the corresponding area, particularly in getting precise forms of error terms. Some of these things have been proved, and some things are still, some people are still trying to prove them, but they're still believed to be true. In particular, in Nevin-Linnar theory, many of the theorems, of course, are going to be about meromorphic functions. Well, in Diophantine approximation, the analogue of a meromorphic function is an infinite set of numbers in a number field. For a while now, at least, I'm just going to talk about the rational numbers. Okay, so it's an infinite set of rational numbers. The Nevin-Linnar characteristic, this thing that we use to measure how complicated our function is in Nevin-Linnar theory, corresponds to looking at the log of the height of these rational numbers. Again, the height of a rational number is the maximum of the denominator and the numerator. And so now if we just take that idea and nothing else and come back to our equation, undo what we did a while ago. So we went from a discrete equation to a difference equation. So let's hoik it back to a discrete equation. This, if I start off with rational coefficients in the equation, rational coefficients, I generate an infinite list of rational numbers. We demanded finite order meromorphic solutions, so that means that the characteristic function should be bounded by a power of r. So the natural analog is to simply say, okay, well, as you calculate the log of the height, that should be bounded by n, okay, the natural measure of how you're stepping through this sequence. And so this is what I've called Diophantine integrability. That's all that you're looking for. And this idea was actually used in 1999, by people trying to, in Paris, estimating the algebraic entropy. So it is an idea that had been seen before in the numerical, in calculations. So let's just look at some simple calculations. I didn't write down the examples here. I'm looking at a class of equations of this form, where An and Bn will be different in the three different examples here. In this line here, so I'm looking at the log of the log of the height versus the log n. So basically, I should see straight lines if I have some kind of a power type relationship, and I should see something else when I have exponential growth. So this lower line corresponds to the case when an and bn are both constants, in which case this can be solved in terms of elliptic functions. It's basically the addition law in the elliptic curve. When an becomes a linear function in n, I get this straight line here, and that's one of the Pan-Levay, this one of the discrete Pan-Levay equations. If I make the symmetric change, so now I keep an constant, but I let bn be linear in n, so kind of from the equation point of view it looks as complicated, we get this massive growth here. So that's really, and that's, you know, generally believed to be a non-integrable equation. So this seems to be very sensitive. Certainly from a numerical point of view, it's very easy to use. The coupon of A6 that we just saw in the previous talk, you can play the same game. So you have all of these different parameters here that I've just set to be these values. Now, in the integrable case, there's a condition relating Q to this combination of the parameters. When that condition is satisfied, we get this curve. So again, it looks linear. When it's not satisfied, we get this. And you can see how far these points are spaced apart. So we have massive growth. Rather than just draw the pictures, usually the easiest test is just how long it takes the computer to try to draw the picture, because you'll get the answer very quickly in the other cases. For example, here I've looked at a lattice equation. Here, of course, you're calculating many more points, but already just with a small number of points, you can see in the case where a is equal to 1, which is the integrable case, then I get something that already looks linear. When a is something else, 2, then I have this exponential type growth. Okay, so it is a useful way of at least trying to numerically determine integrability, and it seems to be very sensitive. But what I'd like to do is really try to study how we can actually use this as, again, in some kind of a classification scheme, how we can actually why we seem to have these processes. In general, the autonomous versions of these equations are essentially the addition law for the elliptic function rewritten. This kind of height growth and the addition law for the elliptic function is something that's extremely fundamental. It turns up, if you just take any book on arithmetic geometry and many on algebraic number theory, you'll see this described, and the height growth turns up in the proof of Mordell's theorem. So it's interesting to think that maybe these Panleve equations, which are really just a very privileged class that in this respect behave like the elliptic functions, but everything else behaves radically different, maybe they have some special number theoretic interpretation. Just again for some formal similarities between the behavior of heights and the behavior of Nevin-Linnet theory. If you've never seen Nevin-Linnet theory, this won't mean terribly much, but there are some useful identities. I can always bound the height of the sum by twice the product of the heights. When you take the log, you get these sorts of identities. These are exactly the identities that are used in Nevin-Linnet theory. Formally, they're exactly the same up to the factors. If we have a rational function in X and D is the degree of that rational function, then the moral of the story maybe is best to just jump down here. The log of the height of the rational function is basically the degree of this object times the height of X up to some error term, where that error term depends on the heights of the coefficients that appear up here. And this is a relation that I think draws again this similarity with algebraic entropy. Okay, so again, well, you can apply that rule very directly to some equations to get some simple estimates. Again, this models the earlier work with Nevin-Linnet theory. So I've got y of n plus 1 is a rational function of y of n, now with coefficients that depend on n. So now, essentially, that previous identity gives me that the height of this iterate is the degree of this map times the height of the previous iterate plus some term that depends on some fixed polynomial of the heights of the coefficients. Okay, so if they're polynomials themselves, this is going to be a term that grows like log n. So as long as I have a solution that grows bigger than log n, and here again we see this idea of admissibility coming in. You can only say things about solutions that grow faster than the coefficients. We're going to have exponential growth unless d is less than or equal to 1, and obviously for higher order cases, you can get the corresponding terms. So again, ideas of growth and integrability go way back, particularly Arnold, Veselov, and Folkery and VLA. Here the basic idea is that you have a map, And what you're going to do is you're going to iterate that map, and you're going to consider what is the degree of the nth iterate as a function of the initial conditions. Generically, that degree is going to grow exponentially, but for special classes of equations, that degree grows polynomially. And algebraic entropy is really a measure of that. Algebraic entropy equals zero is essentially saying you have polynomial type growth. And again, because we have this sort of identity, you could easily imagine if I have a sequence of, if I have a finite number of initial conditions, if I have an nth order equation, n minus one initial conditions, then if I set those things to be arbitrary rational functions of one variable, then as I iterate, the nth iterate would be a rational function of that one variable. And then you could look at this sort of an identity here, and now provided that you can control the growth of these coefficients, because of course it's the degree is going up, the polynomials are becoming more complicated, you also have to control the growth of the coefficients, then essentially this would be telling you that exponential growth or polynomial growth in the algebraic entropy sense would correspond to this Diophantine growth in this sense. We haven't tried to prove through this route, because again you would have to bound the order of the size of the polynomials, the coefficients in the polynomials. In particular, we just want to study this as a number theoretic problem in its own right. Because again, the hope is that maybe these equations will have some number theoretic interpretation. So for example, we know that we have this slow degree growth on certain types of algebraic varieties. We know that the first integrals of the Panleve equations are not algebraic, but nonetheless this seems to be telling us that there's something special about them from a number theoretic point of view. Now, I've mentioned the addition law on the cubic curve, and most of you will know this, but let me just describe it anyway. Will Morgan also has this described in one of the posters out in the session. Basic idea: if you plot an elliptic curve, okay, which in general, well, will have either one or two parts if you're in the real domain, you have a natural addition law. So I take any two points on this curve, draw the straight line through them, you're guaranteed to hit the curve a third time. Really, for that statement to be true, we need to be working in the complex projective space in CP2, because then you have the line at infinity, okay, you have the point at infinity. And the rule then for the addition law is simply you take these two points, draw the line through, it cuts somewhere else, and now flip in the y-axis, at least when you're in via stress form. And this gives you your group operation, your addition, and well, you can actually take any, well, under this rule, the zero of the group has to be the point at infinity. Now, if you just write down the x-coordinate for that, the equation relating the x-coordinates of these different points, so let me be precise, we're going to keep adding this one point to all previous points, so we're going to start off with some point x0 and then add this point and so on, then it's easy to show then that the different iterates are related by either of these equations will work. And of course these are simply autonomous versions of some of the equations that have been written up. Typically you'd shift away this constant and then you'd have exactly the equation I was looking at previously. What is essentially the addition law on the cubic again is the QRT map. So Crystal Roberts' Thompson map is this object here, where firstly you take symmetric. I'm just looking at the symmetric case. So take a symmetric 3x3 matrix, or rather take a couple of them, and create these two vectors, and now take their cross products. That gives you F. 1, 2, 3, and now you plug that in this equation and you've got the QRT map, and it has a conserved quantity, which is this object here, and you can rewrite that conserved quantity in this form, where alpha is, for example, alpha naught minus this constant times alpha 1. So any one solution of this second order equation is a particular solution of this thing. Of course, the k in general varies from equation to equation. But then by looking at the sums and products of roots of this equation, that solution will then satisfy both this equation and this equation. Okay, so again, I'm not claiming that this equation is equivalent to either one of these two equations. You take one solution, you integrate up, and then that particular solution will solve both of these two equations. And that's important from the height growth point of view. So again, here are the two equations that are simultaneously satisfied by the xn's, because there's an identity that's relatively simple to prove, and that's this one here, wherein projective two space. So if I write three things out, the height of that is simply going to be the maximum of those values, provided that I've cancelled out any common terms. Okay, so the height then of this particular combination can be shown is greater than or equal to the height of the product of these two things. Now, if I look at what this object is with u and v replaced by x up and x down, and now use this equation, these two equations, and notice that I'm in complex in projective space, so I can always multiply through by the denominator. So I have these expressions here, and now essentially it's fairly easy to show that the height then is going to be less than or equal to some constant that again depends on the coefficients here, times the height squared. Okay, because the highest power in each one of these three things is the height squared. So putting all of that information together gives you an equation for the heights, and then taking the log gives you this thing. So this, of course, is telling you that the log height grows no worse than n squared. And again, this result is used in Mordell's theorem, at least in the usual elliptic function case. So that really tells you that the log height is growing polynomially. But how would you do some kind of a classification? So how would you look at the bad equations and try to show that they're genuinely growing exponentially? Well, one way is to look at expressions of the height in terms of absolute values. Okay, so the absolute value is just the usual norm on Q. Okay, so it satisfies the obvious relationships. Apart from the usual absolute value, there's a so-called p-adic absolute value. And what that is choose your favorite prime number. Now, any non-zero rational number can be written as that prime to some power, positive, negative, or zero, multiplied by a ratio of two terms that don't have a factor of p in them. And then the absolute value is just x subscript p is, well, it can be any constant to the power minus r, would work here as an absolute value. But we choose this to the value of r, but we choose p here for a very nice normalization that I'll show you in the next transparency. And there's a theorem by Ostrovsky that says that that's it. The only absolute values on Q are equivalent, so meaning they define the same topology, of the usual absolute value, which from now on we denote with an infinity sign here. They call that the prime at infinity. And the p-adic absolute values, apart from the trivial absolute value, which is 1 everywhere except 0. What are some nice things, the properties of these absolute values? Well, you have the product formula, and this is where the normalization comes in. So if you think of what the p-adic norm does, I take your rational function x and now write it as a product of primes divided by a product of primes. Now, as I take the product of all these absolute values, all it does is, it one by one, it picks up a prime from the top and it writes it at the bottom, picks up the prime from the bottom, writes it at the top, and finally you get multiplied by the norm at infinity, which is the usual absolute value, which then puts all the primes at the top again and the primes at the bottom where they belong, and everything cancels out and you get 1. So that's where the normalization comes from. And in this respect, which is the fact that we want to use, the logarithmic height is just the sum of the log plus of the absolute value of p. I did define log plus, but I should have put it again on this transparency. Log plus of x simply means log of x when x is bigger than 1 and 0 otherwise. Okay, so you simply truncate the logarithm curve. And again, it's easy to see that the log height then is just the sum over all the absolute values of log plus of xp. And that's the same, of course, as the log height up the other way. The equality over here is equivalent to the product formula. The equality here is obvious. Okay, if I take a number and I flip it up the other way, obviously the maximum, the denominator, and the numerator remains the same. One other property that we need is that the p-adic absolute value doesn't just satisfy the usual triangle inequality, it satisfies something stronger, and anything satisfying this is called non-Archimedean. Okay, so Archimedean is something that's not non-Archimedean. And we can use this, this is joint work with Will Morgan, to determine some more precise necessary conditions for Diophantine integrability. So let's have a look at this example. And here I'm taking the coefficients here to be constant. You can solve this equation in terms of elliptic functions in the case where either alpha or gamma is zero. So now we're going to look at the case where neither of those two things is zero. And there's a little lemma that's not very hard to prove, that if, so firstly you have to choose your absolute value, so you choose your prime or infinity. You can choose some number epsilon that's going to be bigger than zero, because I've assumed that neither of these two guys vanish, beta might vanish, which is why I've written this in this strange way. There's a coefficient out the front here that I don't need, except in the case of the usual absolute value. And that's exactly where this idea of Archimedean versus non-Archimedean comes in. So when we have the Archimedean absolute value, you get something else here, otherwise you have one. And the upshot of it, and this again is an analog of a singularity confinement, you start by looking at a point where y is small. Okay, remember with confinement you look at zero in this case and then you try to see how you go to infinity. Now we're using these absolute values to say, suppose I start at a small point, and that's going to mean that the absolute value is less than epsilon. Then at the next point, I get something that's correspondingly big. Okay, I have something connecting the ratio of these two guys. And then at the next step, I have this inequality, which is simply saying that the next step is not small. Okay, it might be big. All I care about is that it's not small. So again, the upshot of this theorem is for any of these absolute values, there's a particular epsilon, such that when I use that to measure what I mean by small, I start out at small. One of the two nearby iterates, I have a correspondingly big term, and then I have a term that's not small. And the reason that we want that is that we want to do some kind of an association argument again. I want to say every time I have a small point, I can associate to it one of these correspondingly big points, and I need to know that the next step isn't small again, or else the counting might be wrong, because I might need to have two small points associated with one big point. So again, that's the idea here. We have a small point. That means that either one of these two dots must have this thing satisfied, and at the next point there's no small point. Okay, same over here. I could slide this whole picture over so that I have two large points sitting next to each other, but not. I can't go back to a small point. So I can freely associate this small point with this big one, this small point with this big one. And now what we do is we start by looking at these terms, log plus of the nth iterate, evaluated at p, so I'm going to fix the absolute value for the time being. And now again, based on what we did with Nevin-Linnet theorem, where you look at things on a disk, here I want to do the analog of that, so I'm going to sum up all of these log heights from minus r to r, and I'm going to have a look at how that grows when r goes to infinity. So this is a sum over the iterates here. We're not yet summing over the p's. Obviously, I have to do that to get the height. So we look at this sum, and I split that sum into two bits. One is the small bits, okay, where the xn's are small. That's going to be the term that we have to estimate. And then the second term, where things aren't small, I'm just going to show that they don't get too big, that they're bounded in terms of the coefficients of the equation. So if I have a look at this term, remember that to every small point, I could associate a correspondingly big point. So every time I had one of these points in this interval from minus r to r, somewhere else in the interval, I might have to go a little bit further, I might have to go to r minus 1 to r plus 1, I could find another term where I have this higher power, and then I have plus this term, which is simply this, and now we use the definition of the original exponential to get an estimate of this form. And because I want a uniform estimate at the end, I want to sum over all the p's now. I'm not going to be able to get a maximum survive that summation. I'm going to estimate everything by this big, long, ugly sum. Okay, and now we're looking at how this summed logarithmic height grows. So the summed logarithmic height is just the sum, by definition, it's this thing, which is, look at this expression now, and now sum over all the different absolute values. Well, as we sum over all the different absolute values now, what happens, I simply sum this equation, and that gives me this expression here. I sum this side of the equation, and that gives me this expression here, plus summing all of these guys. Well, again, if I sum all of these guys, I'm just summing over the p's, so all of these terms then turn into heights of these various functions, but in particular they're therefore bounded. And this term, I only pick up one of these terms, this log 3, from the prime at infinity, okay, so from the usual absolute value. And that's an important thing to note, that we only get this term once. Obviously I couldn't have infinitely many of those things adding up, and that's important when you look at this in a more general context of number fields. So what we end up with now, as before, is a linear first-order discrete equation. So provided that the average value of the log height goes to infinity, because I can divide through by this thing, then these terms will eventually swamp decay and will have exponential growth. Okay, so going through, again, you see this remnant of singularity confinement manifesting itself in relating points where the zeros and infinities, or where something is small and big. Just a very quick comment, because this is needed in the classification work. If you need to leave the rational numbers, you can go to algebraic numbers, so you can go to expressions extending the rationals by roots of algebraic equations. And the upshot is that all of this machinery survives, basically. The crucial thing is that you, in general, still have infinitely many non-Archimedean places, or places in equivalence class of absolute values. But you have, crucial things, you only have finitely many Archimedean places. So the only difference in the argument that I gave before was we had one contribution of log 3, now we're going to have some finite number of them. But the crucial thing is that it's finite. So you have this definition of the heights. So since I still have 7 minutes left, let me describe another piece of work that I've been looking at with a student of mine, Neil Southall. And the idea here comes from the ultra-discretization of Panleve equations. So what people have been doing is looking at discrete Panleve equations, then taking a certain limit that basically leaves you in the max plus or tropical algebra. So the key, so now we're leaving complex analysis, we're leaving the number fields, but there's a connection again back to Nevin Linna theory. The fundamental object here is this identity. So in the limit, if I hold x and y fixed, in this particular limit, we get the max of x and y. So basically, if I write little x, little y, little z in these forms and consider these various equations in the limit in which epsilon goes to zero, but the capital X, Y, Z's are remaining fixed, then plus goes to the maximum because of the identity above, the product just goes to the plus, and the ratio goes to subtraction, which we write in this form, so O plus, O times, and O slash. There's no analog of, so this defines the max plus semi-ring. There's no analog of subtraction in this ring. And the zero, the role of zero is played by minus infinity, so the natural place in which these things live is in the interval from minus infinity plus r. And the role of one is played by zero. So in integrable systems, of course, this has been looked at considerably. So of course we have the famous box and ball system, we have ultra-discrete Panleve equations, we have an analog of singularity confinement for, I mean all of these things are known, so there is an analog of singularity confinement for these equations. We're not living in anything like the complex domain. Is there some analog of Nevin-Linna theory? Because part of the idea of this tropicalization is that there should be degeneracies of complex structures. So one thing that you can do is you can look at the obvious definition of what you would mean by a max plus rational function. So you just write down plus and times and ask yourself, what is this object? Well, it's this object here, which is obviously a finite number of piecewise linear segments with integer slope, with integer slopes. So something like this. So the natural analog of what you would mean by a meromorphic function is to simply drop the condition on having finitely many of these jumps. The natural analog of a zero is when you have when the slope increases at some point, so this would be a zero and this would be a zero. Natural analog of a pole is where the slope decreases, so this is a pole, this is a pole. I shouldn't say zero, I'll say root, because it's not a function value. And more importantly, if you want to count multiplicities, then the difference in slope is the multiplicity, okay, which again is always an integer. So the starting point from Nevin-Linna theory is to define this characteristic, and the way that you define the characteristic is you write down what's called the Poisson-Jensen formula. And the Poisson-Jensen formula is a way of writing down f at any point in the disk in terms of some kind of an average on the radius of the disk and the zeros and poles of that function. So you just ask yourself, what's the analog here? So at some point x, I want to assume that I know the function value at the endpoints, and I know the orders and location of the zeros and poles. Well, there's so much rigidity here that that is enough to work out what f is. And you simply write down this expression, and again, it's exactly the form that I described. So there's some kind of an average, and some terms that depend on the zeros. The a's here are zeros, and the b's are poles. And they're, as in Nevin-Linna theory, they're listed according to multiplicity. So if you have a double zero, you just list that number twice. So this is the usual Poisson-Jensen formula, so it kind of looks the same. Jensen formula. So the Jensen formula is when you specialize to the case where x is equal to 0. So if you plug in x equals 0, you have this expression. And now you can express these two sums in terms of an integral of exactly the same form that we had before, except instead of having a 1 over t, we now have a 1 over 2. So again, in this interval from minus r to r, you count the number of poles, including multiplicities, and this is what you call capital N. M, which in the genuine Nevin-Linna case was an average of the log of f on the disk, is now just literally the average of f on the endpoints. And you have this plus type term, just as we had the log plus term. And you have the Nevin-Linna characteristic satisfying this identity, which is one of the fundamental the analog of one of the fundamental identities of the genuine characteristic. So it's really saying that f likes roots as much as it likes poles. So then you could use this object as a way of measuring the complexity of the solutions of ultra-discrete equations. And that's something that we've been looking at recently. Again, you can prove analogs of some of the theorems that Risto Korhonen will be talking about in the genuine Nevin-Linna case tomorrow, some of the things that we need in terms of the classification. You can do some kind of estimation and some kind of early classification work. And this is something that's relatively easy to calculate numerically. So again, you can use it to pull out equations that seem to be of ultra-discrete Panleve type, although I've got to say there is a fundamental difference here, and that is that when you're looking at these ultra-discrete equations, what often happens, if the solution grows, then the solution becomes equivalent to something solving a much simpler equation, because you simply don't see some of the terms in the equation itself. So therefore, just one solution is certainly not enough to distinguish between what you'd think of as a nice equation and not nice. And I think since I'm right on time, I will finish there with simply the 4 points that The existence of enough finite order meromorphic solutions seems to be a good analogue of the Panleve property for difference equations. Diophantine integrability comes from Voiture's dictionary and seems to be an effective numerical test. But I think more interesting is there some kind of interesting number theoretic interpretation underlying this? Just as the elliptic functions are so crucial in number theory, and the discrete Panleve equations, which are certainly more complicated than, and there's a huge gulf between them and everything else, do they have any role to play? And there is a tropical analogue of Nevin Mini Theorist. And I'll leave it at that.